WOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. On the telephone, we have Thomas Greco. Good day.
Good day.
Welcome, and thank you very much for coming on the show.
Pleased to be here, Ken.
Where are you, in Arizona?
I'm in Tucson, yes.
In Tucson. That's a kind of a hotbed these days, huh?
Yeah, the heat has arrived.
Yeah, I'm not referring to the heat either. There seems to be a lot in the news happening in Tucson. But
we've had a lot of trouble with the border situation, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reaction by the state legislature and the governor is really quite predictable, I think, in view of the government, the national government's failure to really do what needs to be done.
Yeah. Let's introduce you, hopefully properly. Thomas H. Greco, Jr., community and monetary economist, educator, writer, and consultant, former tenured college teacher. Let's see. He is the author of a number of books, the most recently being Money, Understanding and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender. No, that's
actually
not...
the most recent book is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization.
Yes, I apologize. I'm sorry. That's right. The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Let's see. Will you kindly finish your introduction to your own satisfaction?
Yeah, sure. My early background was in engineering, and then later, after graduate school, I went into academia. I taught at a business college in the eastern part of the United States. For 14 years before launching out on my own as an independent scholar and consultant and networker and writer. And so I've been doing that for more than 30 years now. And got into the problem of money in a big way about, almost 30 years ago, when I discovered that it was our monetary system that is responsible to a large extent for recurrent problems that we have in the world, like continual war and starvation amidst plenty and inadequate distribution of the benefits of increased productivity.
And this is, of course, money seems to be at the very heart of the entire human culture. And one of the things that you're interested in doing is demystifying it.
That's right.
And exploring, I guess, at least theoretically and practically, alternatives to the current system that is so degraded and really injurious to our prospects.
Well, that's right. Ultimately, we need practical alternatives to a system that is highly dysfunctional. My first book on the subject, written more than 20 years ago, is called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. And in that book, I tried to outline the findings of my research into the dominant money system and laid out the dimensions of the dysfunctions that are inherent in money and banking as we've come to know it. And then I followed that up in 1994 with a second book called New Money for Healthy Communities, which described historical and contemporary examples of exchange alternatives that that we might be able to implement on a community level in order to get around some of the problems with the dominant monetary paradigm. So, and then in 2001, Chelsea Green published the book that you mentioned, Money, Understanding and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender, which was essentially an expanded and improved version of the New Money for Healthy Communities book. And my latest book, published last year, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, actually looks at the whole problem of money in a broad context of politics and social disintegration as well as environmental despoliation. And one of the main points that I make in all of my work is that there is inherent in the dominant monetary system a debt imperative, because the way money is created today is on the basis of banks making loans. when a bank makes a loan, it's creating money. And actually, when that happens, the banks charge interest on those loans. So with the passage of time, there's an increase in the amount of debt. If you were to borrow from a bank, let's say $100,000 to start a business, if the bank made the loan, they would basically create two entries on their books. One would be an asset, which would be your note that you would sign saying that you owe $100,000. And on the other side of the ledger, they would create a liability, which would be a deposit to your account of the same amount. So by making two entries on the books, the banks actually create money. It's credit money. And since they charge interest on it, the amount of debt grows with the passage of time. If you were to not pay any payments, but just let the debt accumulate, let's say for a period of years, at the end of 1 year, if the bank was charging you 10%, you would owe $110,000. And then at the end of 2 years, you would owe $121,000, and so on. Because the interest is compounded, that means interest is accrued on the interest that was accrued earlier. So you have this continual expansion of debt that is required by the nature of the money system. So you have an impossible situation, sort of like the game of musical chairs, only instead of taking away chairs, you're adding people, and there are never enough chairs to go around. And likewise, in this monetary system, there's never enough money to pay off all the debts that are owed. So this causes what I call the growth imperative, and conventional economists continually talk about economic growth as if it were a natural necessity. And under the current monetary system, it is a necessity, because as debt grows, everything in the economy tries to grow accordingly in order for debtors to avoid defaulting on their loans. But the fact is, this system causes some to fail. There must be some defaults, regardless of how diligent and capable the lenders are in putting that money to work.
Why must there be defaults?
Because, as I said, there's never enough money in existence for everybody to pay what they owe to the banks.
Mr. Greco, I'd like to start at the very beginning. What is money?
Well, that's the basic question, and few people really understand the essence of money. Money is nothing but credit. Over time, money has evolved and taken different forms. If you go back to the early days, money was a medium of exchange that was simply some commodity or group of commodities that were in general demand. And many things have served as a medium of exchange. In the past, in the colonies of the Americas, it was common for tobacco to be used as money. Nails, hides, bullets,
goats,
various other things of that sort. Of course, precious metals, gold and silver, typically become the favored materials to be used as exchange media because they have certain properties that make them useful in that regard. But when you consider it, it's still a barter transaction.
Yeah.
In a barter transaction, I've got something you want, you've got something I want, and we make a trade and everybody's happy. But if you have something I want and I have nothing that you want, there can be no barter exchange. So the use of generally demanded commodities like gold and silver provides a solution to that barter dilemma. For example, I might agree to accept cigarettes in payment for something that I have that you want to buy. Even though I have no use for tobacco myself, I know that others in the economy want it, so I might accept it as an exchange medium. But later on, when banks realized that they could lend more gold than they had. Then we had a major step forward in the creation of credit money.
Mm-hmm.
The process that that developed as money was being invented, when money was gold and silver coins, a lot of people would simply deposit their gold and silver with the goldsmith for safekeeping. And in return, they would get a receipt, a note, that said that the goldsmith owed them a certain amount of gold. Those notes themselves then began to circulate as exchange media.
Mm.
So I could pay you with a bank note instead of actual gold, and you would accept it because you knew that you could take the bank note to the bank and redeem it for gold if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Now, when the bankers realized that people weren't coming for the gold, at least not very often, they figured, well, we can issue banknotes not only on the basis of gold deposits, but also on the basis of other collateral. Let's say a mortgage on your house or your farm. So this was a great leap forward in the creation of exchange media. The problem is not that we have credit money. It's the problem that credit money has been badly abused by banks. Now, there are a lot of monetary reformers that want to go back to using gold and silver as the exchange media, but that would be a step backward, and it wouldn't achieve the necessary result. The use of credit money actually enabled a lot of transactions to take place. The amounts of gold and silver, of course, are always limited, and it takes a lot of effort to get more of it out of the ground and to refine it and to mint it into coins. But the use of credit as money is perfectly legitimate if that money is created on a proper basis. Where you get into trouble is when banks start creating money on an improper basis, typically by monetizing government debt or by making loans without adequate collateral mm-hmm. and assurance of repayment.
Mm-hmm. And they would indulge in these practices for what reasons?
Well, the whole system is a system for centralizing power and concentrating wealth, and we've seen that occurring over the last 300 years or so. Every country now has a central bank, and the purpose of a central bank is to do just what I said, to centralize power and to concentrate wealth. Did you ever wonder how it is that the U.S. government can continually spend more than it takes in tax revenues? Well, they do it by borrowing. They absorb your savings and mine, and when those savings aren't enough, the banking system will monetize the debt. That is, it will create money on the basis of that debt, which, of course, is the process called inflation, and ultimately that causes prices of real things in the market to rise.
So we're borrowing from the future.
Well, you could put it that way, but in actuality, I don't think anybody expects those debts to ever be repaid.
No.
At least not in real valuable currency.
Yeah.
The only way the debts will be repaid is by diluting the value of the money already in circulation.
Right.
That's what I talk about, monetizing the debt.
So if I understand, in one form or another, we do need money.
Yeah,
and we will always need money in one form or another.
Yeah, we have a process called reciprocal exchange. You know, that's what happens in a barter transaction. I've got something you want, you've got something mm-hmm. I want. It's a reciprocal exchange. You get as much as you give, and you give as much as you get in terms of value. That's use value. But as I said, to get around the barter limitation, we need to have some exchange medium. And credit is a perfectly fine mm-hmm. exchange medium
yeah.
if it's properly done.
Right. So it, right now the system that we're laboring under that's perhaps ruining our entire human presence on the earth and the Earth itself is pretty much at a dead end. It's being exposed as bankrupt.
I think we've seen that very clearly with the latest boom and bust cycle. The real estate boom ended in a bust, as every boom must, because it's fueled by improper issuance mm-hmm. of money. Mm-hmm. Now, what the banks did, you know, as I said earlier, this system can only be sustained by continually expanding debt. So debt needs to be expanded either by the private sector borrowing or by the public sector borrowing. So what did the banks do? They allowed anybody and everybody, virtually, to borrow money to buy real estate. So in the process of making money so readily available, even to unqualified buyers, that put more buyers in the market, which caused the prices of houses and real estate to be bid upward to two or three times their previous values. Now, those weren't real values. They were artificially created by the abundance of credit that the banks put into the private sector. Now, when the unqualified borrowers were unable to pay the payments on their mortgages, then the banks foreclosed on those properties and put them back on the market, driving real estate prices down. And they had to recognize that huge amounts of the mortgages and the mortgage securities that they created were worthless, that they were never going to be repaid. Right. So what did the government do? The government took those bad debts off their hands, basically by trading them for U.S. government securities in a roundabout process. So they shifted the private debt over to the public sector. So one way or another, debt has to be expanded. If it's not private individuals and businesses and companies that are borrowing new money into circulation, then the government must do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the reason why we're not going to see a balanced budget on the part of the government anytime soon, unless and until this monetary system has changed.
Right. And there's been a long history of alternative currencies, at least theoretically.
Not only theoretically, but in practice, private currencies have a long history. And you can go back in history in the United States, back to the time of the free banking era. After Andrew Jackson vetoed the bill to renew the charter of the Second Bank of the United States, we had a period where each bank issued their own notes, and those bank notes were the obligation of the individual banks. So if you had a bank note of the bank of, let's say, Santa Cruz, I don't know if there was a bank of Santa Cruz, but if you had a note of the Bank of Santa Cruz, that note was backed by the assets and the resources of that particular bank, not by any centralized system. So each bank had to diligently manage their own resources and create money on a proper basis, otherwise pay the price by eventually going out of business,
yeah,
not being able to pay what they owed their depositors.
It's, if I understand correctly, that if we don't fundamentally change our system of money and economics, we're headed directly toward ruination.
Yeah, we're on the doorstep. I mean, we're seeing it now, environmentally and socially. Everything is disintegrating.
Yeah.
And all of our institutions seem to be breaking down and not functioning according to the desired result. Mm-hmm. Our healthcare system isn't delivering health. Our education system isn't educating properly, and so on across the board.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've seen in the last couple of years since the financial crisis of 2008 more and more people being thrown out of work, businesses going bankrupt. We've seen the environment being continually despoliated, and that's all a result of this growth imperative that I spoke of earlier.
Yeah.
So I don't have any hope that the powers that be are going to transform the money and banking system. What we need to do is to create exchange alternatives in our communities at the local level that do an end run around the dominant paradigm.
Yeah.
So we have to create the new paradigm from the bottom up.
So the dominant paradigm essentially is just squeezing the last dollar out of this defunct system.
Well, it's squeezing the last amount of value. It's starving productive enterprise for credit while it's lavishing credit on imperial ambitions and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and U.S. bases all over the world.
Yeah.
And so the military-industrial complex is being lavishly supported with credit, while the mom-and-pop stores and the small and medium-sized businesses in our communities are being starved for credit.
Yeah.
As a result, we have a lot of companies, a lot of small businesses going bankrupt and people being thrown out of work.
Okay, so you speak about beyond money, and you speak about the end of Homo economicus.
Homo economicus. That was a blog entry that I put up yesterday or the day before. My blog is called beyondmoney.net, and I try to post on a regular basis pertinent materials, including video materials from others that I think support the thesis that I've presented and give direction as to how we might improve our local conditions.
So let's move to the thesis. Will you please lay it out for us?
Well, the thesis is that we have to create exchange alternatives that are based on the monetization of the local value added. Now, what that simply means is that we have to create local exchange systems on the basis of value that we're creating in our communities. Mm-hmm. You know, every community adds value in the process of producing goods and services. So let's say that you own a toy manufacturing company. Maybe you import wood from Oregon. Maybe you import screws and nails and fasteners from, let's say, the East Coast somewhere. Those all have a cost. But then you take those components and you put them together into a product, finished toys, that you sell at retail. So by putting your labor and your skill into those raw materials, you are adding value. So whatever value you're adding locally can be monetized locally. That is, we can create a local currency on the basis of that value that is being added by companies like yours in the local economy.
Right. And this, in a nutshell, this is the very essence of what an economy is meant to be.
Right. In the old days, before banking was as centralized as it is today, we had community banks that were there primarily to support the local economy. But banking has become so centralized, very few locally controlled and owned banks remain. Now, there are a few, but for the most part, banking is Citibank and Chase and Bank of America, the other big behemoths that have evolved by gobbling up all of the smaller banks. When I first moved to Tucson 20 years ago, I opened an account at a bank. That bank has since been taken over three times by bigger entities. And in this last round of financial difficulty, we've seen even more banks go out of business and fewer banks emerging. Seems like every crisis results in fewer banks. but bigger banks.
Why would that necessarily be so? It would seem to me that if that local banks could be established and that they would be viable as businesses, viable entities.
Well, they should be if it's done right. But, you know, there's so much manipulation from the top that conditions can be created that force smaller banks to sell out. To give you an example, you remember the savings and loan crisis?
Yes, I do.
This occurred during the late 1980s. What was the cause of the savings and loan crisis? Was it because the S&Ls weren't doing business properly? No, it was because the interest rates were being manipulated from the top.
Yeah.
So you had savings loans that were paying high interest on deposits, and they were already invested long-term in securities that were paying low interest.
Yeah.
So by manipulating the interest rates in the market, the S&Ls were basically forced to consolidate, to sell out, and to demutualize. This is one thing that I talk about in my latest book, is mutual companies. A mutual company is one that doesn't have any stockholders. It's owned and operated by the people that it's supposed to serve. So the savings bank that I had an account at when I was a young boy was a mutual savings bank. And it was later demutualized. That means it was turned into a stock company.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being owned and controlled by the depositors, it's now owned and controlled by a small group of stockholders, and it's operated for the benefit of the stockholders more than for the benefit of the depositors.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all kinds of shenanigans like this that take place that militate against local ownership and local control. But that doesn't mean the situation is hopeless. If we learn what we need to know about the system, we can find ways to get around it.
Well, this is good news. We can de-shenaniganize the system.
Well, the shenanigans will continue to be done. We can't control that. But we can create alternative systems and structures in our local communities that serve our own needs.
Okay, well, how do we do that?
Well,
let's do that.
As I said, by creating local exchange systems. Now, there's been a lot of interest in local currencies and local exchange systems like LETS and even commercial barter exchanges that have been operating for more than 40 years in different parts of the world. And these have the potential of being our mechanism for transcending the dominant paradigm. We had a system here in Tucson called Tucson Traders. It was basically a credit clearing system. Each member had a page in an account book. And when you buy something, your account is credit, or your account is debited. When you sell something, your account is credited. So it's simply a numbers game. You know, when you put value into the community, your account goes up. And when you take value out of the community, your account goes down. So it's just a simple matter of keeping a record of transactions and the price of each transaction. So if you come to me and you say, I have a bicycle that I want to sell, and we agree on a price, let's say it's $100, you get $100 credits to your account, and I get $100 debit to my account. It simply means that you have $100 worth of value coming from the community,
mm-hmm.
and I owe $100 worth of value to the community.
Right.
So you can spend your credits with somebody else to get something you want.
Right.
And eventually I have to work off my debit by providing something of value to someone else in
right.
our community.
Right.
And really, you know, when you think about it, that's all that banks do anyway, is they do this process called credit clearing that I just described.
Yeah.
If you have an employer that makes a direct deposit to your account, when your salary is paid, the bank simply adds a number to your account, and then when you go shopping with your checkbook or your debit card, the bank subtracts a number from your account. So really, the banks are just doing this credit clearing process. Mm. But in our system, an account balance can be negative. In the banking system, the only way you can go negative is by taking what the banks call a loan.
Mm-hmm.
So when the account goes negative in your bank, the bank will say, oh, well, we've made you a loan, and you have to pay interest on that amount. Even though the bank really hasn't loaned you anything, they've just done some bookkeeping. So we can do this properly in our own communities by creating our own exchange systems. And this is a process of monetizing local value added. Mm-hmm. By allowing accounts to go negative, we are basically creating our own currency.
Are you encouraged by the response to your understanding, to your proposals?
Well, I'm not the only one working in this field. I mean, there's a huge movement of community economics and alternative exchange that involves tens of thousands of people all over the world. And, you know, we've had local currencies and LETS systems. LETS is a type of mutual credit clearing that have sprung up in places, thousands of places all over the world. Many of these are still small, and many of them have been transitory, but it's just a matter of optimizing these systems and getting them up to scale.
Yeah. I'm fishing for some sense from you as to whether we're even beginning to embrace these new ideas, or even beginning to begin to turn the tide.
Well, I'll give you an example. Probably the best model that we have for a local credit clearing exchange is the VIR system in Switzerland. That's WIR. And if you go to my blog, beyondmoney.net, you'll find information about that. But VIR was started as a cooperative, a credit clearing cooperative, back in 1934, during the midst of the Great Depression. At that time, there weren't enough Swiss francs in circulation. It was a situation similar to today, where businesses were being starved for credit. So the businesses got together to figure out a way that they could continue to do business with one another, even though there wasn't enough conventional money in circulation. And they came up with this credit clearing process. And so the VIR has involved thousands of local Swiss businesses doing huge amounts of transactions year by year for the last 75 years or more. Last figures I have, which are now a couple years old, indicate that there are 60,000 members, and they're transacting more than $2 billion worth of business amongst themselves every year without the use of conventional money. So I'm not saying that the VIR is a perfect model, but it's certainly a demonstration of the viability of this kind of system.
Let me try another angle here. I'm a common man, and I stand probably with the great majority of men and women whose eyes glaze over when they hear talk of finance and economics. I'm not sure to what degree that qualifies me and others like me as obtuse, or whether the entire field is opaque or not as simple, doesn't seem to be as simple as many suggest it is.
Well, you're not obtuse at all. I mean, this is a universal reaction, and you know, I see it all the time. The problem is that it's not part of our educational experience to learn about the nature of money and banking and finance. And a lot of that has been intentional obfuscation by the powers that be that run the system.
Yeah.
You know, because the money power is the power that controls everything else.
Yeah.
Controls economics, controls politics, and everything across the board. So if people learn what they need to know, we can easily create the systems that we need to have to serve our own interests instead of the interests of a few.
Well, the sentence you just articulated might serve as maybe one of the most important, crucial, central sentences that I've heard.
Yeah, well, we can't afford to be complacent about this anymore. You know, we have to understand the source of our difficulty, and if we don't understand the source of it, we can't find a solution.
So, to the source of our difficulty is a system that is essentially fixed, that moves against our well-being, our interests.
Well, it centralizes power and it concentrates wealth. Now, the system has had beneficial effects, undoubtedly, because it has forced a tremendous and rapid expansion in production and productivity. So, you know, it's not all bad. There have been some benefits, but we've reached the limits to growth, and it's time for us to transcend that
mm-hmm.
system.
Right.
We have to transcend into a sustainable economy and a system in which we have better distribution of the benefits mm-hmm. of our productivity.
So this is maybe the last gasp or the last expression of a millennia-old system of dominance hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is based on survive to reproduce.
Well, when you consider that the ideals on which the United States was founded, government of the people, by the people, and for the people, you can see how this has been subverted by the system of money and banking because it concentrates power in the hands of a few. When the government can spend beyond its means year after year after year, it doesn't have to come to the people and ask permission. If the government wants to fight a war in Iraq or Afghanistan, they just go ahead and do it. They don't worry about funding it because the banking system will fund it one way or another. You know, the original central bank was based on a collusive arrangement between financiers and the King of England. This was in 1694. The Bank of England was founded when William Paterson and some of his financial cohorts went to King William III with a proposition. At the time, William III was fighting a war against France. And like all wars, that war was very expensive, and the king needed to raise money in order to pay for it, to pay the soldiers, to buy the supplies, the weapons, and all the other things needed to fight the war. Well, William Paterson came to the king, and he said, we will give you the money you need if you will give us a privilege. And the privilege was that the Bank of England would be able to issue banknotes and to lend them into circulation at interest. So this was the beginning of the central banking system, which has spread throughout the world to virtually every country today. So most every country in the world has a central bank that sits at the head of a banking cartel, the private commercial banks that actually make the loans and put money into circulation.
Oh dear, there's something gnawing at me here, and it's this, I think. It seems pretty clear and pretty cut and dried that we're Well, there's many words that can be used. Enslaved might be one of them, that we are enthralled to a system that has been in place for a long time, that's deeply established, that's a dominant system, and that has reached an end of anything resembling a future, a growth future. We have pretty much exhausted the low-hanging fruit on the planet, and the engine is running out of fuel. And I guess from this point forward, we can feed on each other for a few decades, maybe. But it's curtains. It's a lights out scenario.
Yeah. Well, the question is this: you know, are we going to battle with one another over the remaining dwindling resources, or are we going to pull together in a way that we can make sure that everybody gets their needs met? That's the basic choice. Now, I've been reading a book called Natural Capitalism. It's been out for a while. And I think it outlines fairly clearly what our dilemma is and what the choices are in terms of the physical economy.
Who's the writer there?
Amory Lovins, Hunter Lovins, mm-hmm. and Paul Hawken.
Mm-hmm.
They were the co-authors on this book a few years ago.
Yeah.
It's a very good book, and I recommend it. But basically, they don't talk about the financial mechanisms that enable the existing paradigm, and that's what we have to understand, because we take it for granted, and it's really one of the linchpins in the system that's causing our distress.
Why don't we hear people like yourself yelling?
Well, you hear me yelling. I think there is still a general misunderstanding of the nature of the problem. And so I have my part to play, and I try to make people aware as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. I think 10 minutes ago you used the word easy, referring to possible alternatives or possible solutions. And again, this grinds against me, because if we have solutions, if we have viable, sane, human-based
solutions,
that's right.
Okay. Well,
what's in our way, or what are we waiting for, or what's taking so long?
First of all, they are happening. Most of them are still at a stage of development, which is small and generally unnoticed. Secondly, the resources needed to put them into effect have been difficult to come by. Thirdly, the conditions in the environment have not been favorable. You know, the more the shoe pinches, the more attention it gets. And it's only within the last couple of years that there's been a general distress, and people are beginning to look up and question the dominant paradigm and say, what's wrong here? And what can we do about it? But I'm very optimistic. I'm seeing some very promising projects emerging. You know, we have transition towns movements. We have sustainable economics groups popping up all over the place. And these are good lead-ins for exploration into the nature of the exchange system, money and banking and finance.
Mm. And, of course, there needs to be a tremendous amount of public education.
Right. Now, these things have gotten quite a bit of journalistic attention, you know, going back several years. New York Times, LA Times, Newsweek, Forbes, all these mainstream publications from time to time publish stories about local currencies and exchange systems. But it's not a very penetrating or analytical kind of story that they do. It's just sort of a, oh, look at this quaint development here in this little town.
It's not sexy.
Yeah, well, it is sexy to an extent, but it doesn't really get at the essence of what what is going on or what needs to happen. And a lot of these local currencies haven't been done in a way that's truly empowering. Many of them are just sold for dollars, which really doesn't get us out of the dollar trap.
Right.
It doesn't monetize the local value added, which I said is the thing that needs to be done.
Yeah, yeah. We had a man named Charles Eisenstein on the show here, who is a fairly brilliant young man, I believe. And he's composing a book about money. And he spoke about something called negative interest. And it was one of the most fascinating things I'd heard in a long time. Does this ring a bell?
Well, negative interest, I think, falls under the rubric of demurrage. That's what Silvio Gesell called it 100 or so years ago. And there are a lot of people talking about demurrage, but I don't think it's a necessary component of the systems that I'm advocating. Zero interest, yes. Negative interest, I don't see a need for that.
Okay. Yeah, it. I think what one of the things that thrilled me about listening to it was, I don't know, it just seemed so alive. It seemed that the idea that money would actually lose value if it was held rather than circulated was rather intriguing. But you're saying that that's really not necessary.
It does have some surface appeal, and the demurrage concept gained a lot of traction during the Depression. And in fact, there were many local currencies issued at that time. They were called scrip. And even Irving Fisher, a noted economist from Yale, wrote a book called Stamped Scrip. And many of these issues of currency, you had to attach a stamp periodically in order for it to maintain its face value. And the stamp could be bought for a penny or two, and it needed to be applied once a month or so. The idea was to keep money circulating to prevent it from being hoarded. The idea being that if people had to put a stamp on it, otherwise the note would lose its value, then they would tend to spend it before the stamp was due. That's fine as far as it goes, but in a credit clearing system that's properly designed, you don't need to have that incentive. Credits, if they're properly created and managed, cannot be hoarded. And I write about that in my second and third books.
I think I just saw some bill in India that had Gandhi's photo on it, and it was worth zero. And I forget the story now, but it was another one of these. It's kind of like I don't know the word for it. There's something thrilling about innovation that serves everyone. You know, there's something about solutions or alternatives that just work so well. That's such a win-win-win all around.
Right.
That it's like, good Lord, we're our tongues are hanging out. We're dying for the lack of these kind of fundamental transformations.
Well, that's right. We do have to focus on win-win situations and win-win approaches to our difficulties. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And the kind of thing that I've been expounding and proposing.
Yeah.
You know, if we can create an exchange system that doesn't have this built-in growth imperative, and create an exchange system that makes credit more generally available and makes resources more generally available to people, then we can do a better job of distributing the Earth's bounty, and we can at the same time restore the environment and the Earth's capacity to support life. And that's the job before us.
Yeah. Is this a matter of morality and ethics?
Well, I suppose you could talk about it in those terms, but It's also a matter of sheer survival and happiness.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want a world that's filled with conflict and war and competition for a few remaining resources, or do we want to live in a world that's peaceful and harmonious, where people basically, everybody has the opportunity to fulfill their potential?
Oh.
I mean, that's the kind of world I want to live in.
Yeah. I suspect 99% of us want to live in that world as well. And forgive me, but let me circle around one more time to what's standing in our way.
Well, at a very fundamental level, it's our own attitudes, values, and beliefs that determine, to a large extent, our behavior. But it's not only that. It's also the structures and the circumstances in which we find ourselves embedded. This is a very important point, and one that I make in my last book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. The famous Stanford prison experiment that was conducted by Professor Philip Zimbardo, he took a group of ordinary students, and he had a mock prison created in the basement of the university, and some of the students were assigned to be prisoners and others were assigned to be guards. And he observed their behavior over a period of time, and the experiment was supposed to go on for 2 weeks. He had to terminate it after 1 week because the mock guards became so abusive of the mock prisoners, and people got so much into their roles that it was becoming really an untenable situation. So his main thesis from that experiment was that human behavior is determined not only by our predispositions, our own individual attitudes, values, and beliefs, and our upbringing and traumas, but also by the situation that we happen to be in and the systems in which we are embedded. So we need to pay attention to changing those circumstances and those systems as well if we want people to behave better.
Yeah. Okie doke. Forgive me for botching your introduction. I just want to take another shot at it. Thomas,
okay.
Thomas Greco is... regarded as one of the leading experts in monetary theory and history, credit clearing systems, complementary currencies, and community economic development. And the newest book is The End of Money. Where did that go? What's the subtitle there? The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Couldn't be much clearer. And the fundamental approach based on private initiative, openness, and voluntary participation. I guess what you're saying is that there are solutions available, that the system that we're suffering with is has got to go, and maybe the sooner the better.
Well, the system, I think, will eventually fade away, but we're not trying to compete with the system. We're just trying to do what we need to do in our local communities in order to create a better economic situation and a better situation overall. The system will continue to do what it was designed to do, but we don't need to be negatively impacted by that if we can create our own alternative exchanges.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very, very much for coming on the show.
You're most welcome, Ken. My pleasure.
Thank you. Thomas Greco from Tucson, Arizona, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. He's got a couple of websites, reinventingmoney.com, beyondmoney.something.net.com. Anyway, you can Google him. He's right there, and pursue his teachings as you will. Thank you, Thomas Greco. It's about 5 to 1 on Monday morning, June 7th, 2010. This is KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. The show is called What Now? 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Mondays on this station.